usual. I was taken aback. Our home room is usually next door. Today we have four items on the agenda, and I'm not going to try to anticipate in advance dividing up the time into four even segments. If we get done with the first item in less than 25% of the time, that's okay. So the first work session is the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. Ms. Byerly, would you please give us an introduction?
Sure. Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee. Back during the Department's Ethics Commission's budget discussions last regular session, there was a budget note included in the budget report having to do with how the agency is making progress on its use of technology to improve its access and availability of training. So the Department's back today to give you an update on how it's been doing with that budget note, and this is the response required under the budget note.
Thank you. Mr. Burson, would you like to deliver some information for us?
Good afternoon, committee members. My name is Ron Burson. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. I had submitted a report on January 27th. Everybody has that. So I won't bore you folks with reading that report, but I do want to go down and highlight some of the actions that's happened in the very short amount of time since the last session, that about approximately 7 months' time. And probably the number one thing, and I listed number one here, is the agency actually lives in the Morrill Crane Building here in town. It's a private building, and quite frankly, the bandwidth was challenging for us. It ran a T1 line to our agency, and that really limited what we could do.
You're talking literally about communications and transmission, not bandwidth in space or resources. You mean the literal version?
It was a limited amount of information that we could transmit and receive at our building. And there's a few small agencies in that building, including myself, and we went together and were able to change our communication line from T1 lines to fiber optics. And what fiber optics gives us is essentially an unlimited bandwidth. So I guess I'm not an IT person either, but what they told me at the time was if we ever need more, they simply turn a dial and give us more. They don't have to put more line in for us like they did in the past. So that was a long process, but it really did help out in the delivery of the electronic training formats that we've come up with. The agency is in the midst of purchasing some basic equipment to try to upgrade some of this electronic formats that we have out there, and one of those is a webcam. Right now, our webinars that we're doing are essentially audio. The people really can't see our trainers, and we can't see them. And so if you actually listen to them go on, they're using voice over IP, which is a computer phone line, essentially. But we're always stopping to ask questions. Does somebody have a question? And so to make it less clumsy, we really like to have some video contact with the people that are taking this. Just to give you some stats on what's happened so far, we're doing to the tune of about two webinars a week since September, when we were able to start these programs. We've done 37 webinars, and what I mean by that is that is a set training program. People sign up for that training program, and it is in a kind of a set subject, such as conflicts of interest. Executive sessions is a big popular one with us, because a lot of these small local jurisdictions seem to have some challenges with conducting executive sessions out there. The other delivery modem that we use now is we use the state's iLearn program. And this iLearn program is actually a set of training programs that are out there that anybody can look at any time. In other words, they don't have to wait for our schedule to produce a webinar. They can actually look at this information at any time. And right now we have 8 audio training programs that, again, go over different portions of the ethics laws and the public meeting laws around conflicts of interest. Right now, we are beginning a program where each Friday the agency is offering basically an open question program so people can call into the agency again through this webinar program and be able to talk with one of our trainers and just ask questions. Sometimes those questions we can answer on the spot. Other times they'll be given a written response back. So it's kind of a time for them to communicate with the agency, and it also gives us a chance to find out really where the areas out there that people are struggling with in the ethics laws.
And just to make sure we're all understanding things the same way, who is they and who is them? It could be people in state agencies. It could be local government officials, right?
That's correct.
School districts.
Well, to
anyone.
To use our funding model as an example, since I have budget and management sitting here next to me and LFO, we have roughly about 1,700 jurisdictions that actually pay a fee to us to help fund our agency. And so it can be any one of those 1,700 jurisdictions. And then that, on top of that, there's also the state agencies that are out there. So it can be city, county, special districts, and, of course, state agencies. Lastly, what we're trying to do, and this was, I think, another suggestion from the agency, is we're trying to create a program where we can work with the other state agency trainers that are actually in charge of answering questions inside their agencies around ethics laws, and we can train them to essentially train their own people so that we reach one person and that one person reaches many people inside of their own agency. So our limited training staff is not trying to train every single state employee that's out there, but we're training the folks that are talking to the people inside the agency. So currently that's what we're done. If I can be happy to answer any questions that folks have.
Yes.
Ron, back in the last session, there was quite a discussion about the possible reduction of your staff, and we did not do that. I'm wondering how that's working out.
Well, first of all, I appreciate that. Just right now, I would say that one of the biggest requests from our agency is in training. I mean, the complaints that we get in that our investigators work, those have always been pretty steady. I mean, they kind of go along at 100, 120 a year, right in there. But as we've expanded our kind of reach out there for training, asking people what they want, we're getting more and more requests for that, and we're getting more and more requests to be creative in our delivery of that and not just in-person training, which, you know, that's still necessary to do, but it's not as efficient as, say, doing some of this stuff over the web. But just to point out, since we last met, last July, or since July, you know, we've had over 1,200 people that have sat before us in more formal type classroom settings in the evenings or in the, you know, during the day to be trained. So now one of the struggles that we've had in the training, unfortunately, is one of my employees has fallen ill, and we are having to find other ways to make that up because the demands still come in, but hopefully that her health will be back in top shape here real quick.
Is this, Madam Chair, is this the kind of a job you could bring somebody in temporarily to fill when you have an illness like that? Or is this job too complicated?
Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Gerard, the problem is that when these folks are training, whether it be on this webinar, because, again, that's live, it's just over the Internet, or in person, there are questions that come up that the people really need to have a thorough understanding of the ethics laws. And as the folks before me here and myself, you know, we have worked very hard to understand those laws over the last few years. So it's really difficult for me to bring somebody just kind of off the streets to do that. What ends up happening is either I fill in or one of our investigators fill in, which both of us have an extensive knowledge of the law to be able to do that. So our customers never really understand our lack of resource, but that should be fixed here pretty quick, that health issue. I just brought it up because when you allowed me to keep the second trainer, it has definitely helped in the last few months because of this illness. I don't know if I could have kept up without it.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Burson, I remember one of the other things we talked about was when there's a demand that doesn't go away, and it's even increasing for information, but it's not always information that you want to get just once a year. You need to know that, how to solve that problem when the problem comes up. Not necessarily remember that 1 or 2 years ago when you were elected to a school board or a city council or a county commission, oh yes, I heard something 2 years ago. What specifically was I supposed to do? You need to, in other words, it's more on demand. So one of the it seems like the iLearn or the ability to call in on a Friday with a question, some of those are good solutions. We also talked about, however, the cost to your agency to send a trainer several hundred miles. But again, you're training people at a time when it may be a good thing that they are exposed to the information, but did they need it then? And that's why we were encouraging the use of technology to help defray some of the expense of all the time as well as the hard costs of travel. But then there's also travel for the people in local government or the county council or city attorneys who need to come. So are you seeing that in the next year or two you will start having basically a different way of viewing how you give information to people, so that we'll see costs shift maybe from supporting technology, to support technology and shift it away from the hard travel costs so much? Because that's one of the things we were wondering about.
Chair Nathanson, just to be upfront, this agency is really always trying to manage its travel costs, and I understand what you're saying is that I think there's going to be some times when we do have to have somebody out there, but we need to, when they're out there, kind of get the biggest bang for the buck. In other words, if we're going to travel, let's go talk. Not talk to the county council from Clatsop County. Let's go to their yearly get together when all the county councils are sitting there, so I could talk to all of them at one time. But I do see a shift. I see a shift in this agency putting more resource into technology. And I also see a shift, instead of reacting to training requests, that this agency gets out in front of it and makes sure that when people do elect new board members to school boards, who are essentially volunteer folks that may have never spent 1 minute in government, that they know what they are not supposed to do. So that's really the big shift that I see is, and the delivery of that has to be through technology. But I do see a shift where this agency gets out in front and people know, I've got a new board member starting. Let's have them do some basic things. Let's have them participate in the Friday webinar, hopefully where they can actually see us here in the near future and be able to ask the questions that they have. I own this business in town. When will I be met with a conflict of interest? And they can ask that specific question that benefits them specifically. But at the same time, the other folks that are listening to this may have a very similar situation and may want to ask the same question but didn't want to come forward. So I think it's an exciting time. I think it's a time that this agency, like I said, quits kind of reacting to the demands that are out there and gets out ahead of some of those demands.
Thank you. From budget management, did you have anything to add?
Madam Co-Chair, no, I don't.
Are there other questions? Ms. Byerly, anything to conclude?
No, Madam Co-Chair, just that LFO recommends that the subcommittee acknowledge receipt of the report.
Would that be a motion?
It would be a motion, but I can't make one.
Madam Co-Chair, I would move that we accept the report from the Oregon Government Ethics Commission.
Discussion on the motion. Objection. Motion passes.
Thank you.
Appreciate the update.
Thank you. I want me to carry on for that item.
Is Darren reminding me?
You want to carry on?
Yeah, sure.
Sure. Representative Gillard will be the carrier. We're shifting now to three items from the Department of Administrative Services. Mr. Hill, can you introduce us to the first item here?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Department of Administrative Services is required to report on debt service savings on the refunding of bonds, and they are here to do such a report.
Okay. Mr. Jordan, and anyone else
Jack Kenny.
At your invitation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Mike Jordan. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the state and the Director of the Department of Administrative Services. With me today are a number of staff, and we'll go through the introductions as we go. But Jack Kenny is here today to talk to you about a refunding of some debt. So, Jack.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, again, Jack Kenny, Capital Finance Manager, Department of Administrative Services. As Mr. Hill pointed out, we are required under statute to report on refundings and general fund savings related thereto. On November 6th, the department sold $101.6 million in bonds. We achieved present value debt service savings of $6.1 million from that refunding. $1.6 million of that present value savings related to general fund programs. Those are noted in the letter that was submitted to the legislature. There was an additional $2.2 million in savings that was attributable to master settlement agreement tobacco funds that were associated with the OHSU bonds that were sold back in 2002 and 3. The refundings did not increase the term of debt service, and interest rates achieved were from 2.5 on the Series O to 3.05 on the Series P. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
You can leave the building now, I guess.
Thank you.
That's far enough. But.
Is there any action that's necessary on these? Or?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the committee, we're going to handle each one of these as a separate action. So
okay.
The LFO would recommend that you acknowledge receipt of the report.
The chair would seek a motion.
I'd move that we so acknowledge.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Is there any objections? Seeing none, the committee accepts the report on the capital investments.
Do we get a carrier for full?
Need a carrier. I guess that's Nancy. Senator Whitsitt, would you be kind enough to carry that?
Sure.
Thank you, and I'll return the gavel now.
Thank you. Next, we have the report on statewide internal audit activities. I'm very interested in this report.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. With me, I have Pamela Strobel, who is the internal auditor in DAS and chairs the audit committee of all the auditors here at the state, and she's going to give you the report. So, Pam.
Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I am Pam Strobel, the Chief Audit Executive at the Department of Administrative Services. You have received fiscal year 2011's annual report on statewide internal audit activities. In this report, we do highlight the beginnings of a plan to develop a strategic direction for internal audit in state government. Since the presentation last year on the annual report, various stakeholder groups have met and begun discussions around the future of internal audit, primarily to address the way these services are currently being provided across state government around the limited resources that we have available for this function. I'd like to highlight just a couple of the key objectives out of that report, and that the strategic direction part of the report is on page 4. We will be seeking ways to collaborate across the enterprise to assess risk, potentially identifying and auditing high-level topics that span across agency lines, and following up on audit recommendation implementation. We'll be continuing to train and strengthen agency audit committee membership to provide adequate governance and oversight to the internal audit function across state government. And, of course, the Department of Administrative Services and the Statewide Audit Advisory Committee will continue to provide oversight and to promote the internal audit function. As you can see in the report, agencies continue to face budgetary restrictions, which have prohibited some from filling the internal audit position, as we reported last year. Seven agencies that are required to have a function did not during fiscal year 2011. However, several of these agencies were in the recruitment process at the end of last calendar year. Several of them also are seeking contracted resources or are working with each other to be able to potentially share resources. So we hope to see some of those filled soon. Since the report was issued, we have one group of four agencies in the public safety arena that are working together developing a plan to pilot concepts for sharing internal audit services across those agencies, one of which is not required and does not currently have an internal audit function. So we'd be actually providing internal audit services to an agency without an internal auditor. Once this is tested and if it's determined to be successful, this could possibly be a model to consider implementing in other mission similar areas in state government. This annual report also includes a list of 95 audit reports that were issued this year to continue to provide valuable information to agency management teams around the effectiveness and efficiency of their operations, sufficiencies of controls within their organizations, and compliance with the various levels of state and federal guidelines. Thank you very much for your time today, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Yes, Representative Airbrew.
I just love another accountant. So let me just get this so I understand. This seems to be focused, your report seems to be focused on what the internal audit function is going to be. So you're developing this internal audit function. Is that correct?
There currently is an internal audit function in state government. What we're focusing on is how might we be able to improve and enhance the effectiveness of the internal audit function across all of state government. Currently, only 30 agencies are required to have an internal audit function, and agencies are struggling to continue to meet that commitment with current budget restrictions in place. So we're looking for, are there other ways that we could provide this service across all of state government to kind of enhance that?
So, I appreciate that, trying to do more with less and share the resources while keeping your independence as much as possible. But in the actual internal audits that occurred, was there anything that you should highlight to us that is of concern to you as an internal auditor with the agencies?
I apologize, Madam Co-Chair and Representative Airbrew. I'm not totally sure I understand the question.
As you're doing the internal audits, was there anything that should be brought to our attention? Is there anything of concern that you can highlight for us?
So what we're reporting on is all of the internal audits conducted across all of state government. So those would be individual. All of the audit reports are individual specific to each agency. So I wouldn't be able to address that question on a whole on a statewide level today. I apologize. But if there are specific audit reports mentioned in that report that you would like specific information related to an agency, we can get you that information.
Did you have a question at this point?
I do,
Senator
actually.
Woodson, and then
actually.
Representative Smith.
I'm not sure what I expected in this report. I'm somewhat disappointed in it, Madam Chair. Since this budget note was put into effect, our state revenue has fallen by $300 to $400 million, and we appear to be still getting ready to get started to find a way to create a better internal audit situation. Mm-hmm. So I guess the first question is, when do you plan to get started?
Perhaps I should take that one, Madam Co-Chair. Senator Whitsitt, the front part of this report talks about convening all of the audit resources from the across state government to try and get at that very question, how best to use the resources that we have to try and fulfill the audit obligation in state government. As is obvious in this report, we've failed once again to actually have audit resources in all of the agencies that are required in statute. And you're absolutely right in your observation about our resource situation. So the convening that we've done since the end of the last biennium is to try and get our heads around how do we actually, first of all, prioritize the risks across state government. Currently, the audit function is agency by agency by agency. And to be honest, I believe that if we assess our risks as an enterprise, we will find that some of those agencies' risks, or at least the things that we are assessing as risks within an agency, wouldn't rise to the level that we would use our resources on an enterprise level. And so the first obligation, I think, is for us to look at prioritization of risk across state government more effectively than we're doing today and utilize those resources better. And then the report does talk about recommendations a little bit on how to take the resource we do have and focus it better. So that's where we are right now. I will tell you going forward, and we're going to talk a little bit more about this in a later report regarding the 10% and the budget note at DAS, but the notion of taking these what I will call internal service functions, and trying to figure out how to align the resources we have better at an enterprise level, you'll find reflective in the other things we talk about in these other reports. So this is a parallel process, obviously done within the audit function. Audit functions is a little different than some of the others in the sense that independence is an important issue. Trying to make sure that they're aligned with being able to help management is another issue that we are dealing with, perhaps a little bit uniquely in audits versus things like IT or HR or facilities management. But we're following a similar kind of process to try and get at the issue of how do you focus resources when you are in a situation where resources are declining, or at least they're constrained, let's put it that way. How do we focus them best at the risks in the enterprise? Mm-hmm. Sorry about the long-winded answer.
Thank you. Can I follow up? I think that probably priority should be something considered here. When you are in a falling revenue situation, it would seem to me that agencies would actually be trying to count their pennies and have someone doing that. Someone qualified to do that on a priority basis rather than not having an auditor. I'm a great fan of enterprise audits, and you mentioned that. Could you flesh out a little bit more how you plan to do that within agencies and when you plan to get started on those?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, let me start, and Pam may want to fill in because she has more detailed information than I do. Again, my intention is that through the 13-15 budget, we would, for lack of a better term, reconstruct the audit function so that we can do exactly what you're saying and apply the resources in an enterprise way. We've started a bit of an enterprise-wide risk assessment regarding information security, and we have to go further than just information security and look at all risks across state government. But that's going to take time, and those auditors will need to give us, the management of state government, their best information around where the highest risks are so that we can apply those resources at an enterprise level. Again, currently, those resources are devoted on an agency-by-agency basis, and we have to shift that thinking so that we can apply those resources differently. And Pam may want to take a different tack on this, but that's my approach to how we get at this issue.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I can just add that I do just want to make mention that the agency internal audit functions are currently operating, those that are fully staffed right now or that are staffed. And so they are performing risk assessments and audit work currently in their agency now. So we're not starting something new. But what we are working to do is convene all of the internal auditors in state government. We've already met. We're working to schedule time to work together to bring our risk assessments together to start looking at risks that span across the enterprise. And Mr. Jordan has invited us into the enterprise leadership team at some time in the future. We don't have a timeline established for that yet, but to begin talking about risk at that level and how we can best add value to that management team as well. So it's underway. We don't have timelines, but we are working on it right now.
One follow-up, please, and that is on page 13 and 14 of A15, you have your audit risk, audit report risk, and there are several of those high-risk audits. I guess the question is, you have already identified the high risk. Now, for instance, maybe perhaps the Department of Education, who hasn't bothered to have an auditor, may have high risks that you don't know about. And I'm assuming after looking at their budget for a number of years, they most likely do. But here on these three pages, you have several high risk identified already. Why aren't we focusing on the low-hanging fruit first?
I'll let you answer.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt, these actually are audit reports that were issued last year. Mm-hmm. So these were audited.
Then I guess the question is, what are we doing about the high risk? We've identified the high risk. Now, what are we doing? Are we helping them develop an enterprise budget to fix that? Or are we just filing the information? I mean, what are we doing? We know where the risks are. What are we doing to alleviate that risk?
So then management teams are working to implement recommendations based on these audit reports that were issued. And then auditors do have a process to follow up to ensure that that implementation process is happening and report back to management that, yes, audit findings and recommendations are being implemented.
And Madam Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt, if I may, I'd like to use as an example the risk assessment that we've just completed regarding information security at an enterprise level. These assessments of risk have been done agency by agency, mm-hmm. and realizing that this does give us some data and some indication about the levels of risk within individual agencies. Given the kind of resource that is available in most agencies, one auditor, there are a couple with more than that, to do an assessment of information security at an agency level, first of all, is inefficient because our systems are integrated. But secondly, they don't usually rise to the level at an individual agency basis. So, again, while these pages are some indication of risk assessment on an agency-by-agency basis, we have larger enterprise issues that we would like to be able to assess, have our auditors assess those risks, and then at an enterprise level be able to have the resource that we have currently, try to have that applied more strategically to get at those enterprise risks. That's the idea behind trying to do this at a broader level. I hope that helps.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
You guys covered my question.
Representative Garrard.
Thank you. Is there any connection between the audits you conduct and those by the Secretary of State's office?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Garrard, we actually most of us maintain a pretty close relationship with Secretary of State to actually not duplicate efforts. So internal auditors assess risk within their agencies and develop an audit plan. And Secretary of State has a separate function that they perform to select their audit topics. And we talk to each other and communicate with each other. On occasion, we may provide information to each other about specific audit topics, but we actually try to cover different areas and different risks within the organization to provide more audit coverage.
Good answer. Thank you.
Thinking.
One further question. Thank you.
Okay.
I under the Oregon University system on this audit report risk, none of them are ranked, and I wonder what that means, and particularly to Arena Construction and Financial Aid. The Arena Construction. The prospectus there gave a lot of us concern at the time that bonding was put forward, and as I recall, Financial Aid overspent itself severely the first year, and then they came back for more money the second time. So, what does that unranked mean,
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt? Auditors are actually not required to report risk assessment of at the audit report level, and so that actually was not a required piece of the report, and I tried to explain that at the beginning of that table. So some agencies just don't provide that information, but I can put you in touch with the Oregon University System Chief Audit Executive and get that information for you, or get further information on that audit if that would help.
Thank you.
I'm thinking back to a year ago when this committee when Joint Ways and Means first got interested in this topic, when we were looking at what is usually a pretty perfunctory receipt of an annual report. You look at it and say, thank you, we acknowledge receipt of the report. Except a couple of us asked questions. We realized that in reading the report, of the 30-some-odd agencies required to do one, if you added up all the numbers, who did an internal audit using internal staff and who did an audit using someone else, we realized there were two or three agencies that must have been required to do an audit that didn't do one. So we said, well, why is that? So we asked a couple questions and asked a couple more questions, and one of the departments was a very big department. One was a not very big department. So again, assessing risk, well, maybe there's not much risk from not having done an audit last year here, but this other place, wow, you know, that seems kind of odd that with all the activity and all the money, there's not an auditor, and now in staffing reductions, there's really not going to be an audit. So it's just raised a lot of eyebrows. Well, what does this mean? How can we have rules that require an audit, and then someone just doesn't do one? Does that mean you just don't get to follow the rules when you don't want to? So we asked those questions in this committee, and subsequently, there were some meetings of in the executive branch, and I'm very pleased to see that the response is stepping back and taking a systematic approach to, okay, what are we supposed to be doing? If we're supposed to be doing audits, let's make sure audits happen, and who's supposed to do them? And if they say they can't afford it, how can we enable our agencies to be audited, and how can we afford it, because we really need to do it? So I'm glad that you took the time to figure out we need to do it a different way, and we need to make it happen. So figure out how to make it happen, and we'll be interested to see how it all unfolds.
Madam Co-Chair, if I may, just briefly, while not wanting to prolong a dialogue, I want the committee to know that I don't think it's acceptable that a department that's statutorily required to do a risk assessment hasn't, even if we are short of revenue, even if our resources aren't necessarily applied uniformly across all these agencies, realizing there are some holes here where there aren't currently auditors on staff. I don't think that's an acceptable excuse for this body. And so our commitment is to find a way to make sure that we're doing what the statute says we're supposed to be doing. And we'll find a way to do it within whatever resources we have as long as the statute says we have to do it. So that's my commitment to you.
Well, thank you for the report and the work that has been accomplished so far to try to remedy the situation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Are there other questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Looks like we're ready to move on to the... we will need to receive a report.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, LFO recommendation is to go ahead and accept and acknowledge receipt of the report from the department.
And did you have additional advice or recommendations on this one?
No, just that I do sit on the statewide audit advisory committee with Pam and Mike and several other folks around the audit community. I do believe that in the more recent discussions with that group, there has been a strong desire to really look at the enterprise approach and try to come back to this body with a more robust plan and some very specific things that have been accomplished. So it seems like that's headed in a very good direction.
Madam Chair, I would move that we accept the report from the Department of Administrative Services on the statewide internal audit activities.
Discussion on the motion. Objections. Motion passes. And Carrier, I think we've spread it around to two. It looks like I'm it on this one. The fourth and final report for our committee today is on the administrative savings and motor pool budget note.
Madam Chair, just a couple of preliminary remarks before I introduce Michelle, and Brian King will come up on the motor pool for the second part of this. As you recall, there's a budget note in our budget which requires us to report back to you on a couple of things in this session and actually deliver for you on something in the next session regarding our administrative costs. I'd like to put what you're going to hear, particularly around the 10% note, in a little broader context. Since we last met in the end of the last session, we've been doing a number of things to try and change the culture of state government, at least at the highest management levels, to try and think about, as we just had a little discussion of around audits, think about our management work in a broader, more enterprise-level context. I have convened the top 20 to 25 agency heads, including the other constitutional departments, Secretary of State, Treasurer, et cetera, to turn them into an enterprise leadership team. I'm a big believer in co-leadership and shared responsibility among management to try and manage the entirety of state government. I would like to say that that process is going well. I would say we're still practicing. Folks have not been hired or socialized into state government at the agency head level to manage all of state government. They've been charged and socialized into an environment where they were in charge of a certain mission in a certain agency, and quite frankly, they didn't have to care about a lot of the other things. And so changing that culture is going to take us some time, and we're getting better at it, but we're working at it. It's one of the big contexts. The other big context of change, which I hope you'll keep in mind as you hear this report, has to do with the governor's 10-year plan. I've talked to you at length about that plan, so I don't need to go into that today, but it really does change the way we think about our work in terms of what we're trying to accomplish on the ground in Oregon for Oregonians, not necessarily what we're trying to accomplish agency by agency by agency. And so trying to think about how we manage that collectively has a big part to do with how we do our services internally to state government. And that's what Michelle's going to talk to you a little bit about today, how much progress we've made and what we're anticipating doing through the next budget cycle regarding that 10% budget note. So, Michelle.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michelle Gaines. I am currently the lead on the activity around satisfying this portion of the budget note. I want to start by saying what we haven't done, and what we haven't done is approach this as a collection of percentage dollar reductions agency by agency in order to meet a simple 10%. As Michael has framed up, what we wanted to do is really address the underlying problem, which is we want to find ways to minimize the cost of operations or the cost of delivering services so we can maximize the amount of dollars that go into program delivery. We also took your direction in that even though this is a budget note for the Department of Administrative Services, it requires the reductions to be done in every agency budget in 13-15. So we know who needs to be involved. We know what the goalposts are for delivery and the mechanism that you want to see that in. What we've been focused on is how are we going to do that in a way that doesn't simply turn over a collection of spreadsheets that may not be sustainable change and may or may not affect the efficiency of operations and help us achieve our long-term objectives statewide as the enterprise. And so what we've done, and as you can see in the report, is that we have taken the time to assemble the leadership team to meet the collaborative requirement of pulling together agency leadership from across the executive branch, as well as subject matter experts from across those agencies, to really dig into what the underlying cost drivers are when you take that view. Because the truth is, when you assess things at sort of a higher evaluation, as you often do, you get a different sense of what the problem may be rather than when you address it agency by agency. So we have been focused on governance structure. We have been working with this effort and with others to put in place the leadership teams that are going to be the decision-making and analysis groups that will evaluate the programs that go forward, not agency by agency, but within the context of the different administrative functions, assessing how that might impact the state in that enterprise view, and then making informed decisions and recommendations that will then be translated back into the individual agency budgets. But we will still be able to tell you how each individual agency's budget rolls into furthering those goals when we can look at the other side of the cube and look at it by administrative function. One of the key things that we needed to do, because on one hand it's pretty easy to name what administrative functions are, IT, HR, where it gets a little more complicated is that each agency, of course, may have certain nuances on the level of detail that they track those items. And so, frankly, even getting to a shared term or a shared definition of what we want to say this is as an enterprise. We have been focusing in nailing down those definitions, and we're doing it in such a way that we can capture a comprehensive baseline across the enterprise. We're through the definitional work, and we're about to launch into gathering the information out of all the various systems to put in place that baseline that we would use in order to show the 10% mark in the 13-15 budget, but frankly to also be able to track going on into future biennia. The other piece that we're establishing with that is at the same time is to working with groups that are tied into the performance measures, so that as we're defining a particular enterprise IT effort, we're also want to be able to frame it up in such a way that we can report out on, if you will, operational measures, cost per transaction, things of that sort, that we can use the same measure agency to agency to agency and be able to show improvement in the operations over time in that case. So that body of work is going to be done in the March-April timeframe. In the meantime, we've also collected information from across the agencies by administrative function area. And part of that was accelerated at looking at options that could be of use to us in this biennium for various reasons, and then things that will be moved into 13-15 and staging things up in the 15-17 biennium and longer in relationship to what is being framed out in the 10-year view of what we want to accomplish and what those outcomes want to be and what programmatic services will be needed at the various agencies and what that then means for administrative services to support getting there. The third sort of thrust is working closely. We can't really get this kind of information into the budgets without integrating it into the process that we have as state agencies in establishing the budget criteria and preparing those materials. So we are also integrating into the 13-15 budget process for how we're going to put our evaluation teams and decision-making bodies and the criteria that the budget folks at all the agencies will use to be able to pull this information together. We're integrating it into that process that BAM, Budget and Management, oversees with Department of Administrative Services, so that there's just that one mechanism or that one report that agencies need to do, but that we can pull it and tie it in together. So those are the key activities. We do feel that we are on track to be able to have what we need in time to hit those deadlines of preparing that budget material. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Questions?
Yes. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jordan, you and I have talked about this separately, but I'm curious, and I think the committee would be interested in talking a little bit more about how likely you foresee it that agency heads and others under their supervision will be able to integrate services. Because ultimately, I had people in my office today talking about things that we're going to be seeing in the sub on human services, about protection for child care in the jobs program and protection of employment-related child care, which are essentially the same thing and are supervised by two different programs. And people essentially transition off of the jobs program into ERDC. It makes no sense to me, frankly. And I know that's not specifically under your purview since that's in DHS, but it's an example, I think, of the kinds of things that we've spoken about. And I guess I'm just really interested in what kinds of conversations you've been able to have thus far. A little bit more detail on that.
Sure. Madam Co-Chair, Senator Steiner-Hayward, I'll preface by saying this answer might wander a bit, so be careful what you ask for. I've spoken to the committee briefly about our intentions regarding how we're setting up the governor's proposed budget process for the next biennium. And one of the essential parts of that process is to break agency budgets down into programs and to attempt to get them to align themselves in ways that they haven't done in the past and communicate, prompt communication through the criteria that we will use to evaluate their programs. So normally in the state's budget, the criteria that are used, first of all, they're not always very clear. But secondly, they're almost always what criteria? So what are you delivering to the citizen in the state of Oregon? And that's how we judge the quality of the program. We're going to add to that a how set of criteria. So not only what are you delivering and how important is it to citizens, but how are you actually doing it? And are you doing it in the most efficient, effective, leveraged, aligned manner to get the best value out of our dollar? And also try to see where our disconnects are, because some of these programs we have track people through a course. For instance, climbing an economic ladder, and where do certain benefits come and where do they go, and does that make sense? And so we're going to try to evaluate that better through this process. As it pertains to what we're talking about today, we are going to actually try to extract these administrative overhead costs, and I use the term with great love, those administrative overhead costs, and we're going to try to evaluate them separately from the direct costs of service delivery of programs. That won't be perfect the first time through, I guarantee it. But it will be the first time ever that I'm aware of in state government that we've actually tried to extract those costs and those systems and take a look at them at an enterprise level. So, for instance, HR. We have about 5 or 6 HR shops in state government that are bigger than DAS's. And more robust to deliver HR services. Now, I'm not here to tell you that that's wrong. What I'm here to tell you is they're not aligned and working together as a system to deliver HR services across all of state government. Not only do we have those big, robust nodes, if you will, of service in state government, but we also have a whole bunch of agencies with almost no service in HR. And think about the risks. We just got done with a discussion of risk. When we don't do HR well, we get to write really big checks with lots of zeros and commas in them. And so we have to figure out a way to do those kinds of things better. And that's really the point of trying to do this process differently. I want to add something that is a real big concern that I didn't have when we met last year. And that is... we're going to be asking experts in their field, the people who run HR, IT, finance services inside state government, to redesign their service, make them more effective and efficient across the entire enterprise. I have a really nagging concern in the back of my head. We are organized as the flattest organization I've ever seen, 92 agencies. And, oh, by the way, I just heard today we get to create a 93rd agency. According to the last legislative session, we get to create a new one. So that many agencies, about 100 to 150 boards and commissions, they all report to the same person. Now, I'm not saying that they shouldn't ultimately report to that person, but there's nobody in between either. So it's such a flat organization, it's very difficult to figure out exactly how to manage something that flat. So here's my dilemma. I'm going to ask people to redesign their service delivery system for some internal service across a corporate structure that I'm not sure makes any sense. I don't know that that's a fair task to ask anybody to do. And so I'm going to Sage here a question that we're going to have to grapple with, and that is, are we actually organized as state government, as a corporate entity, in a way that you can actually manage it well and provide those internal services in an effective way? So get ready for a lot deeper dialogue, not only about these services, but about the actual corporate structure of state government. Those have to be integrated somehow. I'm struggling with that right now in my own mind. So get ready in 13. We're going to have a really fun dialogue about this stuff.
That was really interesting. Thank you.
For policy wonks, I think the response is,
yeah, we're
is,
real dorks. We really like that part.
I like that part.
And you've scared us enough now. Okay.
Anything about motor pools?
We do have someone to talk about motor pools.
Okay.
That's the next step. Brian?
Do we report on the... Oh, it's the same part. Never mind.
So the second part of the budget note had to do with some questions around the motor pool. And today I have Brian King, who is the manager of the state's motor pool, to talk to you about what he's been up to vis-a-vis the budget note for the last few months. Brian?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian King. I'm the Department of Administrative Services fleet manager. And I wanted to give a summary of the report that was submitted. That was a six-pager. I won't go and bore you with going into every single detail on that, but cover the highlights, especially with the first one, the underutilized vehicle part of the budget note, to look at that closer, keep working with the agencies. That's something near and dear to my heart, so I really enjoyed getting into that with the agencies. We've done a lot of work with many of those agencies, and we've still used the formula that was given to us by the Secretary of State's Audits Division to calculate that point, and that's that 590 miles on average per month. So we began engaging our agency customers way back in September 2010, the largest customers we have, about 80% of the vehicles that we have assigned of the 3,800. So those vehicles are scattered all over the state, delivering services to Oregonians. And the consultation we've had with them, the additional data we've been supplying to them, has really developed into a different kind of relationship with them, giving them better tools to manage those resources, and produced some results, which I'm happy about. So far, 67 vehicles have been turned in by those agencies as they've examined the uses of those vehicles across their enterprises. We give them the more detailed information. They've helped give us feedback on what would work better for them and incorporated that, and we supply it to them quarterly. So they can look at their different operations and really get down to where are we, what is the usage in this program, what is the usage in this location, and make some adjustments accordingly. The Department of Human Services, Seniors and Peoples with Disabilities has turned in 15 vehicles, and they examine when a vehicle comes up for replacement if they need it anymore. That's a big step for an agency to look at. Well, you know, instead of just saying, we need another vehicle, do we need it at all? That's a great step. The Department of Corrections has taken that even a little bit further and turned in 24 vehicles and centralized across the entire department that vehicle management. There's one person that all the requests have to go through. What's going on in utilization in these different areas? They turned in 4 vehicles last week. They're looking to turn in some more. So they've taken a little bit step further. Department of Environmental Quality has turned in 5 vehicles this past period. And they're the only agency that's reduced their usage of vehicles every year for the last 5 years. That ties to their mission as well, to reduce their impact. So I think that's part of who they are. The Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, they also turned in 5 vehicles, and they are, again, reevaluating what is going on with their program. Do they need these vehicles, and turning some more in? The other piece that we did is we tightened control of additional new vehicle requests. That has gone to the point where anytime one of these agency customers is asking us for a vehicle, we're asking for additional justification about why they need another vehicle. And the other piece that we've done recently is with the enterprise leadership team that Mike mentioned, is he came to me, and when we wanted to do some policy changes, we involved the Fleet Management Advisory Council, who are the fleet experts across the enterprise, to get together and say, what should we do to manage these vehicles better? We then took those recommendations to the enterprise leadership team to get their more broad enterprise, basically vetting of what we were going to do. And we received that, and that's what we're going to do going forward into this next quarter. One of the other parts was the review of the replacement life cycle for vehicle purchases. This is something that we've done quite a bit of research on and used materials from other states, the National Association of Fleet Administrators, and also with the consultant that did our most recent legislatively required third-party review. And this developed into a replacement schedule that meets industry standards and also is effective for long-term cost-effective management of the fleet and a replacement schedule that meets that. The basis of it is, the details of it are in the report, but the basis is that a vehicle should be kept for about 8 years, 115,000 miles, and then examined for is it time to get rid of that vehicle. Now, as you move a little closer, if you're using a vehicle very rapidly, say 3,000 miles a month is being driven, that vehicle can go 3 years, but 240,000 miles, because the residual value is still high, and it hasn't really encountered any large problems. We're currently behind an optimal replacement for the fleet. This is primarily due to the budget reductions taken in 2007-9. That reduction was accomplished by extending the mileage out to 130,000 miles for standard vehicles, 175,000 miles for hybrids. At the time, that reduction was absolutely the right decision because of the fiscal situation, but it was expected to be short-term. It's because it does have detrimental effects to the health of the fleet and to the vehicles that the agencies use to complete the missions. One of these is the major one, is that the date that the vehicles would be replaced was simply moved forward in time, and now they're all coming due, along with the other ones that were moving forward to get replaced. So we had this bubble of vehicles that basically moved forward to now. The other part is what's called aging of the fleet. This is where if we have just a set replacement of 130,000 miles, an agency, say in a prison, with a valid low use per month for that vehicle could take 18 to 25 years to reach that point. And by that time, that vehicle has been probably repaired more times and at a cost that would be more than buying a new vehicle halfway through. The other part is that it prevents us from getting some cost savings because we're buying new vehicles with better and better fuel mileage. That's something the government is pushing manufacturers towards every single year, to get better and better mileage on their vehicles. If we raise the average miles per gallon that we achieve in our vehicles just by 2 miles per gallon, that's about $800,000 in savings a year in fuel costs for the DAS fleet vehicles. So that's, again, a long-term management strategy that helps us down the road. For the standards for determining which cars to purchase and the equipment packages included in those purchases, DAS and the other state agencies follow what's in state policy for new vehicle acquisition, and that's mainly around alternative fuel vehicles, low-emission vehicles, hybrid vehicles. Those are the first ones we're looking at to buy if there's a viable and cost-effective option for that. It's also that we have to meet certain federal standards for the number of vehicles we buy in those classifications. Right now, it's 75% are supposed to be alternative fuel. The other piece is also examining what is the overall life cycle cost of the different vehicles we're looking at. We examine the initial long-term costs in a couple methods. One is primarily determining what vehicles and features meet the need of the agency. DHS needs decent-sized sedans with a good back seat they can throw 2 to 3 car seats in, or a minivan. So those are the types of things we look at. Once we get past those points, what is the vehicle costs and the manufacturer discounts offered? The state gets very good government discounts on vehicles, and it's a huge factor for buying vehicles. And some of them are much better than others. The domestics give better discounts. Ford has been beating everybody lately with that. It might have something to do with the bailout stuff, I'm not sure. The other piece that we look at is what equipment...
Get it.
Huh?
Sure.
what standard equipment is available on fleet versions. Fleets also get an option to buy what's called a fleet version of a vehicle. These are usually a little bit less fancy than what the public might see, but they still include standard features like cruise control, power windows, and things like that. And then we get into the fuel efficiency and the alternative fuel capabilities. And if available, we also look at what is the history for that manufacturer and their vehicles in maintenance costs over time. These factors are used to determine what is the best return on investment we're going to get out of whatever vehicles we're going to buy and put into place. The last part of the budget note was around the agency vehicle purchasing authority and the rationale behind that. That's an interesting question, and the current state is really about an evolution of DAS's role in management of vehicles over time and what's in statutory authority for different agencies for them to operate their different pieces of equipment, and the reviews from the Department of Justice about what those different authorities mean and how they mesh together. And I wanted to give a real brief history about how we came to be where we are today. And it started way back in 1951.
I'd like to interrupt you for a minute because I'm looking at the clock, and I know at least one of our committee members has already accumulated a question or two that I hope we don't forget. I'm going to interrupt you for a moment.
Guess who?
Just so we can ask a question about what we've heard up to this point in time. Representative Girard.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I appreciate your alibi. Ryan, you were talking about the health of the fleet. What the hell happened 2 weeks ago when the Salem Motor Pool got flooded out of all those vehicles? And why wasn't somebody mining the ship? And how much did that wind up costing us? And how much does that throw everything you've just spent the last 20 minutes on out of whack?
I was going to go into the flood piece after this, but I'll move to it now.
Well, it's all right. I can wait. I've been very patient. You know, I've only hit Nancy with the elbow twice. So.
I think it might have been three, but I wasn't.
Oh. All right.
What really happened was there was no real warning like we had back in 1996 about that this water was going to be coming at us and how high it was going to get. When I showed up at the pool, we were looking at what was going on and hearing that Turner was having some problems upstream of us, did an assessment of what's going on a lot, and when I drove in there, there was no water. 10 minutes later, it started pouring in very rapidly. I mean, very rapidly. Within an hour, it was higher in the back part of our lot than we could safely drive sedans through. This is how fast the water rose for what we were trying to deal. And our folks went out there wading into those rising floodwaters to try and move whatever the newest vehicles we could first to get them to safety, and then trying to concentrate on the next batch that we could get out, all the while the water kept going higher and higher and higher. And that's really what happened on that Thursday. And we did the best we could with what was coming at us, you know, down the river, basically, through the backfield. Right now, we've moved 160 damaged vehicles. They're being assessed by an independent examiner that was hired by State Risk Management, as well as the what I call the supplemental insurance provider for the state that is also examining those vehicles. They'll be looked at for which ones are total losses versus which ones can and should be repaired. We also have made new plans for what was based, you know, our business continuity plan was based on the experience of 1996. We needed something new. So we've developed an evacuation plan that will allow us to quickly move out 250 to 300 vehicles, call on extra staff, as long as we have some of that preliminary warning. And we're working with City of Salem to try and see if we can get some of that warning. If they have systems, who else might have systems that we can tap into? As well as not bringing all the vehicles back on site.
Brian, does anybody in the motor pool ever look at the weather forecast?
Yes.
I mean, you're telling me this goes back to 1995 and the plan you had to move those vehicles. Gosh, we still had radio, television, newspaper, which was telling you get the heck out of there because it was going to rain and not never stop. What I'm trying to figure out, why didn't somebody do the buck stops with you?
why wasn't something done earlier? And I'm not trying to pin anything on you particularly, but I understand you're trying to work to prevent this from happening again, as you should be, but that was negligence in my eyes. And
Madam Chair, Representative Girard, I really appreciate what you're saying. I think we have a lot to answer for in this incident, and it's not just the motor pool. And oh, by the way, the buck stops here. Brian reports to me, and it's my job to make sure these things work. And Brian's right, we are changing the procedures. Just, I believe that if you live by Mill Creek and you've lived there more than a couple of winters, you probably ought to understand that it's a flashy body of water. I cross the Molalla and the Pudding every morning when I come to work from Canby. And I can tell you if it rained all night, the Molalla will be up and the Pudding will be up 2 days later. I can set my watch by it. So we need to do better, and we need to understand that we live in a flood-prone zone, and we need to do better. But it is not only the motor pool. We had a number of buildings who are in close proximity mm-hmm. to Mill Creek that we had difficulties with. And we need to do a better job overall anticipating those kinds of issues. It isn't the first time the basements of Ag and Veterans have flooded. I guarantee that. And we should know that we need to be prepared for those kinds of events. And we need to get better data. We need to have a better relationship with our emergency service providers so they can give us warnings when they're the ones who watch the forecasts intensely and really understand the dynamics. And we need to have a better relationship with them and have better plans. And there's no question about it. Your point, your comments are on point. Let me put it that way.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. I'm done, Brian. He took all the wind out of me.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm going to allow one more brief question and brief response and then ask you to finish in about 5 minutes, which will leave 5 minutes remaining.
Thank
Senator
you.
Winter.
Actually, two quick questions. The first one is those vehicles were self-insured.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt, they're self-insured, but once the loss to the state in an event reaches a certain point, it kicks over into the underwriter or the supplemental insurance, which is carried by Lexington.
And how much is that?
The policy?
Yeah.
$4 million.
$4 million. Okay. Yeah. And second, on the real question here, you have your 590 miles per month minimum. That's about $300 a month in mileage. And if you look at the insurance and the which I assume is self-insured, but you have to figure that in, your fuel, your upkeep and depreciation, that seems to me to be really, really low.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Whitsitt, the formula that the Secretary of State gave us in the audit does take into account what is the cost of the depreciation on the vehicles, the costs of the self-insurance, as well as the administration of the vehicles as well. And it's a comparison to the private mileage rate in order to calculate where is that break-even point for 590. We have done some analysis of that formula as well as what many other states have done to figure out, is this the best way to calculate it? I do concur with you. I think it is a little bit low. And when we brought the actions to the enterprise leadership team, we were recommending that we keep it at 590 through 2012 and then raise it up to the next level, which is going to be about 650 miles per month, in order so the agencies have we're staying on a level where we can keep managing the vehicles together and get our feet below us and then take on the next step of going even a little bit deeper into that set. The one of the reasons why it's a little bit low is something that I talked about before with we get very good prices on vehicles, so it drives down the cost of ownership. You and me can't go out and buy a brand new Ford Explorer for what I can buy it off the fleet price agreements. And that is one of the things that drives down that cost.
I was just thinking, I would certainly like to be able to own a car and depreciate it only $300 a month. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Let's hear some more.
Okay. The last part was I was talking about the agency purchasing authority, and I said 1951 was where DAS was given the first authority to create a motor pool of passenger vehicles. This was, the definition of that was things like cars and station wagons. Agencies have language in their statutes that give them the ability to acquire and operate what's termed equipment to perform their mission. In most cases, when DOJ has been reviewing these, what this means is equipment also means motor vehicles. Some of those agencies are places such as ODOT, forestry, state police, have pieces in their statute that have that type of language. Consolidations continued in the 1990s when DAS's authority was expanded to cover all motor vehicles, not just passenger vehicles. And there are certain agencies such as lottery, some boards and commissions, and now the university system that are exempt from DAS statutory authority. The rationale for maintaining the current structure is the combination of allowing autonomy to the agencies that manage their fleets well, while using the Fleet Management Advisory Council and the Enterprise Leadership Team to guide overall management of the state's vehicles. Thank you. I'd answer any further questions.
Other questions? A lot of good information. I appreciate the report for what it's telling us about how you have made a big effort to do things differently. It's already paying off. That will be noticed and appreciated beyond this committee.
Thank you.
Yes, I'd like a motion.
Madam Chair, I would move that the committee acknowledge receipt of a report on a plan to reduce administrative functions by 10% and a report on usage of state motor pool vehicles.
Thank you for the motion. And before asking for discussion, I would ask Budget Management and LFO if they have any additional comments before we consider the motion.
I do not, Madam Chair.
Discussion on the motion. Are there objections? Motion passes. That concludes everything that was on our agenda for today.
Greg wants to carry.
Oh, I'll carry that. Yes, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Are you going to ask for permission to use visual aids?
Mr. King, I just agreed to carry that bill to Ways and Means. I'd like you to be there that day with me. I'm just kidding.
Thank you.
So we've taken care of Carrier. Ms. Byerly, do you have anything to tell us about for next agenda?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, so there will be a meeting on Thursday. I'm hoping that materials should be posted either later today or first thing tomorrow morning. There's supposed to be three items. One is a grant, the Rockefeller Foundation grant for Oregon State Treasury. Public Employee Retirement System will be here to give you their annual report on annual earnings crediting proposals. And then the last item is Department of Administrative Services will be back again to ask for limitation related to the court facilities projects. So that's what's on schedule for the rest of this week. Next week, we should be hearing from Department of Revenue on some reports, and there's a handful of other items that we need to get scheduled as well. So more to come.
Good. A variety of topics. It's always interesting. Any other comments from the committee? We're adjourned.